curtsied me, giving his permission to court. He ought to have been doing 100 other things. Instead, he was preying upon my dead mother's enslaved half-sister. And the wrongness of it filled my voice with a defiant rage. No, I wasn't at your door. I held his gaze, letting him see what he would. My father paused on the precipice, clearing his throat, absently smearing the corner of his lips with one thumb.
Well, did you need something?
As if my needs were at the forefront of his thoughts. My fingers curled into fists as a lie came to me suddenly and sullenly. I was coming up to fetch my prayer book. Surely he knew it was a lie, but I didn't care. If he challenged me, I'd lie again, without even the decency of dropping my eyes. I'd lie because between a father and a daughter, what I'd witnessed was unspeakable. And I'd learned from the man who responded with silence to my letters about politics or adultery or the liberation of slaves. Papa never spoke on any subject he didn't want to. Neither would I.
Are you certain you weren't hurt?
Papa finally murmured,
on the stairs.
Rage burned inside me so hotly, I thought it possible that my handprint might be seared upon the railing. I bobbed my head, grasped my skirt, and took two steps down before my father called to me again.
Patsy.
I couldn't face him. So I merely stopped, my chest heaving with the effort to restrain myself from taking flight. What? A heavy silence descended, one filled with pregnant emotion. I feared he might be so unwise as to attempt to explain himself, to justify or confess his villainous lapse in judgment. But when he finally spoke, it was only to ask,
"What of your prayer book?"
Swallowing hard, I forced words out despite the pain. I've reconsidered my need of it. I'm not as apt as some people to forget what it says. My heart still in turmoil, I drifted mindlessly back to the parlor, where Polly sipped at her cider, Dolly's by her feet on the floor. I wanted nothing so much in that moment as to escape my father and his house, to spirit away to the convent and take my little sister with me. But how would I explain myself to Mr. Short?
"Is your father of a mind to join us?"
he asked, rising from his chair expectantly, his eyes still dancing with merriment from our games in the snow. For me, those games now seemed a lifetime ago, a perfect moment sullied. "Papa won't be joining us."
"More cider for us, I suppose,"
Mr. Short mused, tilting his cup to hide his disappointment. "Didn't you get Sally?" Polly asked, abandoning her dollies. "I'll fetch her." "No," I said harshly, grabbing her arm to stop her. I'd never spoken a harsh word to Polly, much less grabbed her with force. She blinked at me with surprise. "Why not?" "Papa has need of her." How I nearly choked on those words. Perhaps Mr. Short heard the catch in my throat, or saw inside me to where a noxious stew of dark and unworthy emotions still boiled. For the merriment in his eyes melted away to concern.
"Polly, do you know that Jimmy is working on a wondrous new confection made of egg whites and custard and wine? They're called snow eggs. Why don't you help him whip them up?"
Polly's eyes widened with delight, so I let her skip away to the kitchen before I thought better of it. And the moment she was gone, Mr. Short latched on to me with his singular characteristic of prying into facts.
"Whatever is the matter?"
"Nothing. I've grown tired and wish to return to the convent."
His brows shot up. "Before the end of Christmas tide? Your father hadn't planned for you to return until after the religious observances were at a close."
It was his way of reminding me of Papa's antipathy for Catholicism and contempt for Catholic Mass and Saints' Days. Though it was still many years before my father would use a razor to construct his own Bible, cutting out all mentions of miracles and divinity, I already suspected my father observed the holy days only as a matter of form. And the reminder fueled my outrage, making me all the more determined to defy him. Papa's well contented with his servants. He doesn't need me here. And in matters of faith, mustn't we all follow our own conscience? The word conscience echoed between us. Mr. Short glanced to the door and the stairway beyond, in the direction of my father's bedchambers, before rounding his shoulders beneath his dark coat.
"Certainly Mademoiselle Sally can see to your father's comfort, but you're the center of his world, Patsy. Moreover, how would your conscience allow you to leave me utterly bereft of your company?"
In spite of his exquisite charm, I winced at his mention of Sally, dying a little at his unwilling implication of how she might see to Papa's comfort. By the way, he called her Mademoiselle, as if she were a free Frenchwoman. It was only a wince. It shouldn't have betrayed me. But to William Short, I was capable of betraying myself without a word.
"Patsy, sit down before your knees give way."
Then, more quietly, without a note of censure, he added,
"You're old enough now to know the natural way of it between men and women."
There I suffered my second shock of the evening. The realization that Mr. Short was somehow aware of my father's liaison with his slave girl. Did that mean I'd not witnessed its first incarnation? Could there have been other encounters, other kisses, other... Sitting down hard upon the chair by the fire, I shook away the knowing of any of it. None of this was anything a lady of character ought allow herself to be aware, nor something a Virginia gentleman like William Short ought to acknowledge. So I exclaimed, "Pray do not speak another word." But Mr. Short was already more of a Frenchman than a Virginian, and instead of honoring my request, he took the chair beside me and spoke my name very softly.
"Patsy, why not tell me what troubled thoughts are racing under that lace-trimmed cap?"
How soothing he made himself sound, as if he wasn't the same man who had just characterized my father's desire for Sally as the natural way of it between men and women. So soothing that the savage whisper of my answer took us both by surprise, because you, sir, for whom I've unwisely contrived no small admiration, never find fault in my father's conduct. Mr. Short gripped the armrest of his chair.
"How unjust. I've spoken to your father many times about the evils of slavery, and shall continue to do so."
"I'm not speaking about the evils of slavery."
"But you are, Patsy," he insisted. "Should we object to a man's affection for his slave more than we object to the fact that he holds her in bondage? I've told you before that slavery is a practice that compromises our morals, perhaps beyond redemption. Whether we claim a slave's labor in the tobacco field or the smoky kitchen, or in the pleasures of a candlelit bedchamber, slavery makes it all the same."
"It's not the same," I argued, "though, unlike Mr. Short, I had no experience in the pleasures of a candlelit bedchamber to guide my convictions. I had only my conscience, and my conscience cried out that this was wrong. I knew it was. So did William Short. Yet apparently he'd do nothing to stop it, even if it meant putting souls, as he said, beyond redemption. Was it because Mr. Short had seduced and corrupted the Belle of Saint-Germain and his married duchess, too? Did he feel as if he had no standing to judge my father's illicit conduct when he himself stood guilty of indiscretions?" Mr. Short reached for my hand.
his eyes filled with desire, the same desire I'd seen only moments ago on my father's face. "Patsy, it's no sin to—"
"It is," I said, pulling away. Not everything I've felt for Sally Hemings over the years has been noble or unselfish, but that night I perceived a difference between her and the preening, pampered Maria Causeway. With the memory of Sally's tarnished little bell, the one my mother bequeathed her, I felt somehow compelled to defend her. But because I could conceive of no way to influence her circumstance or my own, I was filled with rage not only at my father, but also at William Short, the man who made our helplessness plain. I wrenched away before he could reach for me again, thinking myself miserably foolish to have ever presumed his flirtation carried with it an honorable intent. Foolish to have ever thought Mr. Short wished to court me, or marry, ever. "It is a sin, Mr. Short," I said, remembering all the teachings my father supposed I didn't hear at the convent. I knew God gave us commandments, the sixth of which forbade adulteries and fornications, even those lusts committed only in the heart. Yet the men of Paris seemed to believe the Lord could not see past the glittering brilliance of Versailles into the darker deeds done in its shadow, deeds done under the same roof where my innocent little sister played with her dolls. So it was that with all the righteous indignation that can be mustered by a confused and heartbroken girl of 15, I brushed past Mr. Short without a backward glance. Sally Hemings was as opaque to me as I tried to make myself to the rest of the world. We had that in common. So when she came to brush out Polly's hair that night, she let slip not the slightest hint of anything amiss. In the days that followed at the Hôtel de Langeac, my father's behavior was, in every respect, correct, benevolent, and genteel. Papa was gallant with Polly, spoiling her with gifts on Christmas Day. He contrived to play music with me, ignoring the pain in his wrist, lavishing me with praise and warmly asserting after a particularly well-performed duet that he loved me infinitely. He also announced on the coming of the new year that he'd begin paying wages to Jimmy, who now insisted upon being called James, both generous and appropriate to his new official station as a chef de cuisine, in full command of our kitchen. Furthermore, Papa bestowed upon Sally a wage of 24 livres, plus another 12 as a gift, a sum so wildly excessive for a chambermaid that I could only understand it as a gesture of apology and regret. In truth, this largesse to Sally was all that convinced me I had not imagined the encounter between them. I thought the extravagance must be a farewell to their intimacies. The thought comforted me, and I convinced myself quite easily that it would never happen again. Ever amiable, Sally's only concern that winter seemed to be a desire to be included in Polly's and my doings, and to see the sights of Paris. Meanwhile, Papa lost himself in assuring the credit of our new nation, and shipping wine, rice, silk, and china to friends who requested it. Even the intrepid Mr. Short didn't again mention Papa's encounter with Sally, nor ours in the snow. And I was glad of it, because our friendship had cooled considerably since the night he defended my father's indefensible conduct with Sally, and my suspicions of Mr. Short's moral character only increased when, upon having left Sally to sweep up my dressing room after cutting my hair, I returned to ask her some trifle and caught a glimpse of William Short in the doorway, there where he ought not to have been. His presence there caught me so off guard that I dashed into an empty room so as not to be seen. A moment later, Mr. Short hurried past. As his footsteps retreated down the stairs, I pressed my hand to my heart. What had he been doing in my chamber? My pulse beating in my ears, the question I'd intended to ask Sally was long forgotten, which was for the best. I didn't want to chance seeing her and witness in her eyes or on her face anything that might confirm my aching suspicions about Mr. Short's actions. Up until that point, I'd fervently prayed that I'd misjudged Mr. Short, that in my shock and dismay over my father's conduct, I'd unfairly counted him amongst those men who are unworthy of the kind of affection I bore him. But now I feared that Mr. Short, too, had noticed pretty Sally Hemmings. I won't spare myself by pretending this fear arose only for her sake. Her liaison with my father, however brief, taught me an unfortunate habit of jealousy. I'd already compared my unruly red curls to Sally's long, flowing, dark mane, already despaired of my tall stature against her petite frame, already judged with impatience the plainness of my face where hers was so beautiful. But I was, at that time, still a good-hearted girl with a mind toward decency, and in spite of all else, I harbored great affection for Sally. So it wasn't with all self-serving motive that I treated Mr. Short with contempt, turning from him to my new Catholic faith for comfort. My father didn't know of the rosary that I kept beneath my pillow, but blamed my moodiness on my friends at the convent. One night before bed, he gave me a kiss on the forehead and the following advice.
"Seek out the company of your countrywomen, who are too wise to wrinkle their foreheads with politics and religious superstition like these French women do. It is a comparison of Amazons and angels."
I frowned at him, remembering that he was the one who sent me to the school with all these French women, when I hadn't wanted to go, and that the conduct of women seemed to me, in every respect, less objectionable than his. So while Mr. Short set to work taking dictation as Papa outlined the merits of the Bill of Rights, to be proposed upon adoption of the new Constitution in America, it fell to me to occupy myself with the tender and tranquil amusements of domestic life. While I mothered Polly, the two men worked tirelessly, so much so that their enterprise spilled out of the study into the parlor, where my sister and I read our books. That is how I know that Papa worried about the perpetual eligibility of the president for re-election, a thing he feared would make a mockery of liberty. I was there when, in a tirade, Papa condemned the degeneracy of the principles of liberty taking root in America, and Mr. Short slyly chose his moment to convey an invitation for Papa to join the Society of the Friends of the Blacks, of which he, Lafayette, and the Duc de la Rochefoucauld were all members. My father did pause to consider, but in the end he said,
"Nobody wishes more ardently to see an abolition not only of the trade, but of the condition of slavery. But I'm here as a public servant to those who haven't seen fit to give voice against it."
Mr. Short nodded, as if the matter was settled. But I could see plainly in his expression that it was not. There was a dogged stubbornness about William Short, one that would lead him to hold out hope for a cause long after everyone else knew it to be lost. He was as persistent in matters of the heart as he was in matters of moral principle, though I didn't know it yet. I only knew that I'd judged him to be dishonorable, and yet he stood against slavery, showed loyalty to my father, and had only ever shown me kindness, even when he spoke words that broke my heart. And so, in the helpless way of a girl who has never learned to guard that heart, I'd fallen most desperately in love with him. It didn't matter that I was angry,
It didn't matter that I believed him a knave. It didn't matter that I'd decided to take my vows. Try as I might to deny it, my chest felt empty and hollow on the days when we were parted, and that exquisite suffering was replaced with a swelling ache when I came again into his company. Yes, I was a young girl with a secret love, and this tortured predicament was made only more agonizing by my father's decision to tour Europe in March of that year, leaving instructions that Mr. Short was to watch over me and Polly while he was away. In Papa's absence, Mr. Short's attention turned to me. He came to the convent within days of my father's departure, ostensibly to ask after Polly's health. Strolling through the courtyard, he said, "I want to be able to assure your father that she's recovered of her illness." "She was recovered of it before Papa left," I replied coldly. "But I'll write a letter if he's worried."
"I'll wait, should it please you to have my company while you compose."
There was a thread of hope in his voice, but I knew that my friends at the convent were watching us from the windows above, so I only shook my head. "I would rather send my letter tonight for you to enclose with your own." The disappointment that flashed through his eyes pleased me, and he was back again 3 days later, then 6 days after that. Each time I remained perfectly placid, according him civility, but not more than that. Until at last he visited on the pretext of delivering me an allowance.
"Your father sent this payment, some for you, some for your tuition, and some to the servants."
It was the mention of the servants that made me say, "I'd like Sally to stay at the convent with us. We'll be glad to have our lady's maid close at hand." Settling beside me on a bench, and casually crossing his leg at the knee in a way that drew my eyes to the strong and lean muscle of his calf beneath its white silk stocking, Mr. Short replied mildly,
"Your father considered sending Sally to stay with you, but didn't approve the cost of boarding her at the convent."
"How much can it cost? Perhaps with my allowance and Sally's savings?"
"No, your father doesn't wish to invite inquiries as to the special status of his servants. Such inquiries might not only prove embarrassing to him, but also result in a substantial fine for his failure to register his black servants as per French law."
It surprised me that my father, a great believer in laws, was breaking one. "How large a fine?" Mr. Short's voice did not waver.
3,000 livres for Sally and James each, 6,000 in all. Should their slave status be brought to the attention of the authorities, both of them might be arrested and expelled from the country, or, conversely, they might both file a petition for emancipation in the Admiralty Court, which is certain to be granted, by the way.
There are no slaves in France. That was the official policy. But the specificity with which Mr. Short imparted the legal procedure was not only a revelation, but also a weapon. He must have struggled over whether or not to make the Hemingses aware of their path to freedom. And now I'd have to struggle with it, too. I remember thinking that if he were any kind of a gentleman, he wouldn't have burdened me with it. Then again, no other man would have guessed it would burden me.
"How fares your conscience, Miss Patsy?"
The question drew me back to the night of my discovery, back into my confusion and outrage. "I cannot imagine what you mean."
His gaze darkened. "In addition to your other cruelties toward me, are we to now add dishonesty to the mix?"
I gasped. "My cruelties? What injury do you imagine I've done you?" The squeezing pang of my heart belied my need to ask.
I'd seen the shielded flashes of hurt and disappointment in his eyes, the crestfallen expressions, the false cheerfulness at my coldness. I'd never known before it was possible to enjoy being cruel to a man, and I'd reveled in it. His eyes didn't shield the hurt this time, but allowed it there plainly for me to see.
You've held yourself so distant from me that the only logical conclusion I can draw is that you intend to cause me distress.
I lifted my chin, though my chest throbbed with guilt. Why, I didn't suspect you'd even notice being held at a distance, Mr. Short. You're known to immerse yourself in your own amusements. Why, not long ago, I saw you pay visit to my dressing chamber at the Hôtel de Langeac. He paled, as he ought to have. But when he recovered from his shock, he said,
Please believe I meant no disrespect or impropriety,
as I'm sure Sally can attest. This bitter rejoinder escaped my lips before I could stop it, and I regretted it at once, especially when Mr. Short only tilted his head in apparent bewilderment.
"Sally?" he asked,
as if he'd never heard her name.
"I waited until she went down for a broom so I wouldn't be seen."
I was now equally bewildered and scandalized. "You don't mean to imply that you came to see me in my private chambers, do you?"
Where he'd been pale, color suddenly flooded his cheeks.
"Do you take me for a scoundrel?"
And when he saw I might answer that question, he hurried forth to say,
"I suppose you must. I'm a bit of a one, but not in this. At least, it was in no way my intent for you to ever discover..."
He shook his head. I hadn't the faintest idea how to react. "Mr. Short, if you weren't visiting my dressing room to see Sally nor to see me, then why were you there?"
He glanced away.
"Ask me again when your father returns."
He meant for that to be the end of the discussion, but because my heart was pounding against my ribs beneath my stays, I feared my unfulfilled curiosity would kill me. "You speak of my cruelty, Mr. Short, yet you refuse to answer the simplest question."
"Patsy, leave it be."
Until that moment, I didn't know I had the capacity for coercion. But Mr. Short brought out a great many things in me I didn't know were there. "Since you're so concerned that the matter must wait until my father's return, I'll simply write him about it." Mr. Short turned to me with an expression of astonishment at my threat.
"And to think everyone who meets you praises you as such a good-natured, happy girl with the charm of a perfect temper. Everyone from Abigail Adams to the nuns at your convent assure your father that you're a girl with the utmost simplicity of character."
He gave a rueful laugh.
"None of them knows you in the slightest."
I took instant offense. "I behave as Papa wishes me to behave."
"And he knows you least of all. You're his Amazon disguised as an angel."
This was another insult, or at least it should have been. And yet, I sensed in Mr. Short's tone the hint of approval. Nevertheless, I became painfully aware that we were quarreling in an abbey under the eyes of gossipy girls. "Thank you for your visit, Mr. Short. You may assure my father that I won't spend my allowance on fripperies." It was a dismissal. So he rose stiffly, tipped his hat curtly, but he didn't take his leave.
"What a mess of this I've made," he murmured.
Then, with one gloved hand, he reached into his coat and pulled from some inner pocket a folded note of linen paper. He placed it gently on the seat beside me and added, almost timidly,
"Mercy, mademoiselle. I beg of you."
My mind raced with all manner of villainy that might have been written upon that paper. But when I opened it, I found no ink at all, just a blank page, between the folds of which was pressed a glossy curl of ginger. Is this a clipping of my hair? Mr. Short cringed, as if in the greatest mortification, as if he might like to jump the gates and hop out of the convent, escaping into the streets on foot.
You're most unkind to ask. An angel would have spared me the humiliation.
Of a sudden, my heart pounded even harder, and a flush heated my skin. Then I vow to pretend I know nothing about it.
He sighed with resignation. On the day Sally cut your hair, I took this clipping before she could sweep it up. I hope you can forgive my act of petty larceny.
The implications of this confession broke a fissure in my resentment like the sun cracking open a frozen river. Mr. Short hadn't sought out a private moment with Sally. He'd stolen a token of mine. Overcome with a rush of emotion, I pressed a hand to my chest, crushing the front of my crimson frock, and breathed in as if for the very first time. Why would you do such a thing? He removed his hat and stared at his feet with chagrin.
With our friendship imperiled, I felt the want of a keepsake to remind me of happier times.
My heart insisted it was more than that. I recalled the gold watch key containing a braided lock of my mother's hair that Papa had commissioned, so that he'd never forget her, so that he'd carry her with him always. Mr. Short wanted that kind of connection with me. Why didn't you simply ask me for such a token?
I thought you'd be ill-disposed to such a request. Moreover, I'd never presume without your father's permission, and given that Mr. Jefferson had just confided his intention to leave you and your sister under my protection, any discussion of my feelings for you would have sounded suspect, if not depraved.
Mon Dieu! I thought I might fall into a breathless swoon before I got the words out. What are your feelings for me?
Ask me again, Mr. Short said, snatching back the token of hair from my grasp. When your father returns.
Chapter 10. Was there ever a time or place for love better than spring in Paris? With my father away, William Short and I exchanged witty little notes, discussed books, and railed at the injustice of French commoners paying taxes while nobles and clergy were exempt. We marveled together at the revolutionary spirit in Paris. Indeed, we knew ourselves to be caught up in a singular moment in history, and hoped the whole world, inspired by my father's ideals, was poised to make itself over anew. All the while, I kept my vow. I pretended not to know about the lock of hair. At least, I never again made mention of it during Mr. Short's dangerously frequent visits to the convent. Nor did he openly declare his feelings for me. Indeed, during our long walks, we thought ourselves models of restraint, our behavior above the suspicion of even the most censorious nun. Though we were far too clever together to let restraint or propriety or even our confinement get in the way of affection's bloom. When it rained and we were forced to shelter under the cold gray arches of the Panthéon, we shared a little bag of chocolate drops. Mr. Short said,
"Let's warm ourselves by painting a mental picture of a sun-drenched field."
I laughed, delighted. Given my lack of talent for drawing, I fear to take up the imaginary brush. What else do we see but a field?
Some trees, he grinned. Perhaps a church tower in the distance.
His grin widened.
A pair of sweethearts picnicking together.
Smiling, too, I closed my eyes to the pitter-patter of rain, allowing myself to imagine sprawling upon a blanket with him in the sun. Are these sweethearts well-suited?
Too soon to tell. But they're both enormously fond of chocolate drops, so I have high hopes for them.
That made me laugh. Dear Mr. Short, is a mutual fondness for chocolate drops a strong basis for affections?
It is, if you understand how seriously this fellow regards his confections.
Blinking with guile, I asked, Oh, is he a chocolatier? Mr. Short chuckled, his green eyes dancing with mirth.
A country lawyer by training, but he was induced to serve a diplomat in a foreign land. He's very dashing and a sprightly dancer, too.
The desire to twit him was irresistible. Aha! I've guessed who our sweethearts are. Nabby Adams and her father's secretary, the dashing Colonel Smith.
Mr. Short smirked. No, but our sweethearts are similarly situated. Then, more peevishly, You really think Colonel Smith is dashing? He's a dreadfully stiff dancer, and whenever the man sings, he's off key.
I thought he was your friend, I exclaimed, warming inside at his displeasure in my complimenting Colonel Smith.
He is my friend. That's why I'm so well acquainted with his faults. I taunt him for his lack of musicality, and he taunts me about the elderly French women who are taken by my charms.
It wasn't only elderly French women who were taken by his charms, but I refused to let the thought dim my enjoyment of our game. Let's return to the sweethearts in our imaginary painting. Does the fellow enjoy his work?
He does, though he's worked for years now without respite. He arrived desperately eager to see the continent, but his employer hasn't been able to do without him.
It was a mild, implied complaint that made me laugh, for I believed my papa's resistance had more to do with his fears about young American men being at great risk of corruption in Europe. To work so hard without respite, this fellow must be either industrious or ambitious.
Very ambitious, was Mr. Short's answer. He'd like to be of both service and consequence to his country.
My heart fluttered anew. How could I not admire such a man? How brave to make his career so far from home.
Oh, I wouldn't make too much of his courage. He was so seasick on the way to his post that he now contemplates staying abroad forever rather than face the crossing again.
I smiled at the admission of the shortcoming. But wouldn't he miss his country? Mr. Short contemplated, one finger tapping his lips in a way that drew my gaze there.
He already does. But he's not homesick for some of its peculiar customs. He'd like to return to his native land, secure a comfortable fortune as a planter, and make a home for a suitable wife. But he worries it cannot be done except at the cost of his sacred honor. Do you think that's something his sweetheart could understand?
I swallowed, trying to make sense of his question. That depends. Is his sweetheart a French girl?
Virginian.
In spite of my intention to remain coolly, flirtatiously aloof, my breath caught, and my lips parted as I met his pointed gaze. Then she understands. How ignorant I was. I'd never before given any thought to how difficult it was to prosper in Virginia without slaves. Never contemplated the obstacles of leasing lands to free sharecroppers. Never racked my brain to choose crops requiring only the labor that might keep both the plantation and conscience in good order. The only thing I understood was that Mr. Short was fearful of returning to a way of life in Virginia that he despised.
"And the girl in this picture?" he asked. "What does she dream for her future?"
As tangled as my thoughts had become, the question took me utterly unawares. I had, from the youngest age, been given directives. How to comport myself in a way that honored my father. What to learn to make myself a more pleasing companion. I still heard my mother's reedy voice bidding me to take care of my father all of the days of his life. No one had ever asked me what I wanted.
What can you mean?
He mischievously stole the last chocolate drop and held it just out of my reach.
What sort of life do you think she'd like to lead? Does she wish to marry or give herself to spinsterhood? Does she see herself the lady of a house in town, visiting with her friends and debating in salons? Does she see herself the mistress of a vast country plantation, brewing beer, slaughtering pigs, haying in its season?
My father always spoke as if I would, inevitably, return to take up life on a plantation. Except for my now mostly forgotten desire to join the convent, other choices had never before been presented to me, and when faced with this dizzying array, the words that bubbled up from within me were born of raw instinct.
She dreams of a future in which she, too, might be of both service and consequence to her country.
It was an absurd answer. Mr. Short might have laughed in mockery, or he might have presumed it was a docile, non-committal reply, rather than the ambitious and prideful one it really was. But knowing I was my father's daughter in this and everything, he stared with wonder, surrendering to me the last chocolate drop.
Well, then, Miss Jefferson, the sweethearts in this idyllic painting are very well suited indeed.
The only thing that clouded our sunny romance was the seemingly endless wait for my father's return. It came in April, when Papa rolled up to the convent with a carriage full of gifts for me and Polly. He was eager to talk about the food, art, and ideas the soils of Germany had given him about the best design for a plow, and though he could no longer play the violin with any real skill, due to his injury, I made enough music for the both of us with my new harpsichord, a thing we both treasured. Papa's buoyant spirits delighted Polly and reassured me that he'd be receptive to Mr. Short, should he choose to declare himself for me. Waiting for that fateful moment at the convent school, I huddled together with Marie, my only confidant in such matters, and anxiously counted the days before we'd dine together at the Hôtel de Langeac. Polly, Papa, me, and Mr. Short. What a pleasant little family of four we'd make. I was puzzled then, upon our end-of-week visit, to find Mr. Short not there. My father pulled me into a hug, chiding me gently that I'd not seen fit to pen him but a few lines while he was away. I was ashamed of my neglect, for it was born of my infatuation, and I almost told him as much when asking after Mr. Short. Papa smiled distractedly over a game board upon which he was playing against himself.
He's quite occupied arranging for his travels.
Travels? In his role as my father's secretary, Mr. Short was part courier, part negotiator, part translator, and representative. He was Papa's voice wherever Papa couldn't be. He traveled frequently throughout France and sometimes beyond. And yet, I'd have thought I'd first hear of a new mission from Mr. Short himself. More than that, I feared I couldn't bear the waiting if he should decide to postpone his talk with my father until after such a sojourn. With my heart filled with love that I couldn't express, I was afflicted with the greatest impatience of my life, so much so that I waited up late, going down the stairs on some pretext of needing chamomile tea for an unsettled stomach, when I heard Mr. Short come in. Mr. Short's first instinctive reaction to the sight of me that night was a smile. But then that smile gave way to sadness.
Whatever are you doing awake at this hour, Patsy?
My position on the staircase caused me to look down upon him. I'm told you're to leave Paris.
Setting his hat upon an entryway table, he nodded, gravely.
Yes.
When?
I forced myself to move down one more step, then another.
Soon, if all goes as to plan.
Where will you go?
To Rome and other places.
I was unused to his cryptic answers, and cringed at the way they turned me into an interrogator. Trying to regain my dignity, I descended the remaining step until only an arm's length separated us.
How wonderful.
I know you've wanted to see Rome for yourself. You must be very eager to go. But are you in such a rush that you must leave matters behind you unsettled?
At that, his shoulders sagged.
It was only with real effort that he seemed to square them again and face me directly.
I'm afraid I must.
The acute pain of it was like an arrow. I sucked in air, determined to disguise my anguish. Do you mean you won't? You haven't?
Miss Jefferson,
he began stiffly.
I've had an illuminating conversation with your father. It began with the topic of domestic contentment, and ended on the subject of youth, inexperience, and the need for matured judgment.
Puzzling through his remarks, I wondered if my father had opined on my youth and inexperience or Mr. Short's. Before I could ask, he added,
"In light of this conversation, your father has seen fit to release me from my duties. In fact, he's encouraged my oft-wished-for tour of Europe."
His words sounded like the closing of a leather-bound book, and resounded with a hollow thud. There was no question that whatever had passed between my father and Mr. Short would delay our courtship indefinitely, if not make it impossible. And a thousand emotions passed through me at once. Anger and upset, sadness and fear, panic and a frantic desire to think how I might change these circumstances. Devastation, too, at Mr. Short's apparent resignation. He'd said in the snow that he was a daring man, that he wouldn't stop chasing me. But now he wouldn't risk my father's esteem. Not for me. And despite our imagined painting, and Mr. Short asking what I wanted, I had no say in the matter at all. Still, I could make no sense of this. Hadn't Papa said he viewed Mr. Short as his adoptive son? I'd heard him entreat his secretary on numerous occasions to buy parcels of land near Monticello, near us. Mr. Short shared my father's views, was a fellow Virginian, was familiar and cherished with great affection. Wouldn't it be natural for Papa to welcome Mr. Short as a suitor for his daughter? I was young, it was true, but friends my age were already starting to court and marry. Did my father think I was less accomplished, less sensible, less womanly than those French girls? Distress gripped me, making it hard to swallow. These were all questions I couldn't ask. Mr. Short hadn't declared his feelings for me, and now, if I tried to speak of my own feelings, I might drive a wedge between the men I loved best in the world. Mr. Short must have sensed this, because he nodded and softly excused himself to conduct his business. And for a while, I confided my despair in no one but Marie.
"Poor Jeffy,"
she said, as we whispered in the darkness of our dormitory.
"It is only a trip. If Mr. Short feels love for you now, he'll still feel it when he returns."
Yet I worried that whatever he felt for me was already gone. While preparing for his grand tour, Mr. Short held himself as distant from me as I once held myself from him, avoiding me at every turn.
Long before he left Paris, I felt Mr. Short's absence as a wound to my very core. Worse, I didn't know who to blame. Had Papa discouraged Mr. Short as a potential suitor? Or had Mr. Short toyed with me and given me false hope? I didn't know, and not knowing was a torment. One visit home, while I sat staring unseeingly at my prayer book, Papa took the seat beside me and handed me a small sack. I blinked up at him. "What is this?" I asked, taking it in hand and working at the little string.
"Something to cheer you," he said, a small smile on his face.
He'd meant it as a kindness. Of course he did. For he had no way of knowing that the chocolate drops that filled the bag would remind me of that day Mr. Short and I had imagined our futures. But remind me they did, until I could no longer hold in the torment or the questions. "Why did you release Mr. Short from his duties, Papa?" For a long moment, my father didn't answer.
"As his mentor," he finally said, "it is my duty to shepherd his career. William wishes to be a diplomat, and that requires that he be well-traveled and conversant with places and customs beyond that with which he now has experience."
He said this quietly, seriously, as if this was more than a casual answer to a casual question, as if he didn't fully approve, as if he knew why I asked, and thought me quite improper for doing so. "Will he return to your service when he's completed his travels?" I forced myself to ask around the knot in my throat.
"I hope so. We've talked about his returning to Virginia with me, but each man must make his own destiny. At present, Williams is unclear to me."
I didn't think I imagined that Papa chose his words very carefully, which confirmed what I already suspected. They'd disgust me, or at least intimated that I might be a part of William's future, a part of his destiny, and the result of that discussion had been for Papa to send him away, and for William to decide to go. I asked nothing more of my father that night, because I was shaking with upset, and I feared I would not be able to speak without my voice quavering. Instead, abandoning the chocolate drops on the side table, I simply walked from the room without another word, and sharply closed the door behind me, letting my silence say to my father all that I could not. But I should have gathered more courage that night. I should have pressed and asked him the more direct questions whirling through my mind, because Papa never gave me another opening to do so. My father was always an artful politician, too clever to be drawn into discussions of matters of the heart when his was so guilty, too crafty to be cornered into a confrontation with his daughter that he wasn't ready to have, especially after I'd asked him about William and about William's future. So I was forced to try to win Papa over to reopening the subject. I forced myself to be genial and even-tempered to prove that I was a grown woman with good sense enough to be wooed. Failing that, I hoped my comportment would encourage my father to confide in me any reservations he had about Mr. Short, so that I might put his mind at ease. But at the time, my father's praise of Mr. Short was so lavish and his affection so sincere that it left me entirely bewildered. It wasn't until that summer, when Papa took me to see an opera, that I had my first inkling of the heart of the matter. Squiring me to my seat in gentlemanly fashion, my father asked almost absently,
"Have you had any word from Tom Randolph, Patsy?"
"Cousin Tom? No. Should I have?"
"He'd planned to visit us here in Paris this summer, but I haven't heard from him since his last letter. I worry he's been waylaid by brigands."
This was the first I learned of Tom's intention to visit, I hope no harm has come to him.
I'd grieve of it, Papa said. I've set a plan for Tom's education. I want him to study law in France for 2 years, then embark on a political career. He could be a great man of Virginia. He has an aptitude for it and the Randolph name, not to mention lands and fortune.
That was my clue. So nakedly obvious, I nearly dropped my opera glasses. Mr. Short was a Virginia gentleman with ability and ambition, but he'd divested himself of almost all his landholdings to follow us to Paris. Mr. Short said he had entered the world with a small patrimony, and now, as far as I knew, he relied entirely upon his modest salary, a salary my father perhaps thought too modest to provide for a wife. I understood the importance of financial security, but many of Mr. Short's other attributes recommended him. Confusion and sorrow left me unable to reply. Only one thing seemed clear. Papa disapproved of the man who had claimed my heart, and so he was sending him away. Some part of me didn't believe Mr. Short would really leave Paris, certainly not without a note to explain himself, and some part of me refused to believe it right up until the afternoon when, with guarded eyes, he kissed my gloved hand in farewell, climbed into a carriage, and rolled away. I stood on the cobblestones, staring after that carriage, half expecting it to stop or even turn back. Only when it was long out of sight, and I was shivering against a cool autumn breeze, did I finally surrender to reality. Miserable with longing, I went inside and eased into the chair behind the desk where Mr. Short did his work, reaching for some essence of him and the things he'd left behind. A quill pen, an inkwell, a page of paper. Nothing more. Not even a note for me to tear to pieces and throw into the fire. That night, I sat near a different fire, wondering why it would not warm me, and whether or not I was so heartbroken that I would never feel warm again. Seemingly oblivious to my distress, Papa bade us to see how neatly Sally mended a silk stocking. At her master's praise, she bent to show us her work, and I caught a glimpse of a locket round her neck. A silver opal stamped with flowers and tiny hearts hung on a crimson ribbon, delicate and lovely as the girl it adorned. "It's so pretty, Sally," Polly said, reaching to trace the filigreed locket. "Where did you get it?"
"C'est un cadeau de mon patron,"
Sally said, revealing her near fluency in French. "A gift." Her glance flicked to my father, where he sat reading a book in his stuffed armchair. And though Papa never met her gaze, he smiled. For a moment, I wondered if there was something in his smile beyond kindness. Sally spent her days lighting fires, dusting books, mending stockings, sewing on buttons, and helping James in the kitchen. But how did she spend her nights? She had a cot in the servants' quarters under her older brother's watchful eye. But no one would question if Papa should call for her at bedtime. And how could she refuse? What if the locket wasn't just a gift, but... No. As resentful as I was at my papa, he'd been nothing but gentlemanly with Sally since the night I saw him kiss her. Besides, how could I trust myself to see attraction or affection between a man and a woman, when I hadn't even properly understood Mr. Short's feelings for me? I put it out of my head and dismissed it entirely. I was too miserable with my own troubles to care about the dresses and baubles my father'd bestowed upon his servants. And to add to my misery, in November we learned Papa had requested a congé, a leave of absence that would enable us to return to Virginia. When I gently questioned the decision, he only said,
When we came to France, I supposed an appointment of 5 months. We've been here 5 years. Affairs at home can no longer wait, and political passions here are poised to erupt. I must see you and your sister settled in a more appropriate place.
You intend to leave us in Virginia? I asked, horrified. Was it to rid himself of the temptation Sally presented?